please be seated. Thank you for your patience. Okay, we're now called the second case on this morning's docket scheduled for oral argument, Laney Whitmire versus National Cutting Horse Association. Mr. Walker.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. It is my distinct privilege to represent Laney Whitmire here this morning and to come before you to explain why we believe the grants of summary judgment of Judge Lowe should be reversed and Ms. Whitmire should receive her day in court before a trier of fact in the form of a jury. At issue in this case are essentially three points of error which we've submitted to you. And I'll begin with the first one because I think it's probably the one with the most substance, the most meat on the bone, so to speak. And that relates to Judge Lowe's decision not to interfere or intervene in the affairs of the National Cutting Horse Association in light of the fact that he found, predicated upon their motion for summary judgment, that they had complied with their rules. We believe that they have not sustained their burden in establishing proper summary judgment or in establishing that they complied with their rules as a matter of law in such a way that would support Judge Lowe's finding of summary judgment. Now, we believe that the briefing submitted before you establishes that fact even well beyond the briefing that we submitted to Judge Lowe, and I submit this for this reason. They've changed horses in midstream, to play upon the vernacular. The arguments that they're making here today in their briefing before you in the appeal are not the arguments that they submitted to Judge Lowe in connection with what they contended at that time supported summary judgment in their favor. And the judgment and the arguments they're making here today in connection with the non-interference doctrine are not the same arguments that Judge Lowe relied upon in granting summary judgment at the trial court level. And that relates to the single contention, really, over which there's no real dispute, and that is whether or not the summary judgment was appropriately established that they complied with the rules. Both sides really agree that that's the burden here, that's the issue, that the court cannot interfere or intervene in the affairs of a private association unless they fail to comply with their rules. Their motion for summary judgment submitted at the trial court level very clearly, unqualifiedly stated that, Judge Lowe, you cannot interfere in these affairs governing the membership of Laney Whitmire because we complied with our rules. The problem is that the rules at issue in the trial court were rules 38 and 39. I'm sorry, rule 37 and 38. They now come before you and they try to sidestep that. And in fact, rule 37 isn't even attached or mentioned on appeal here today, even though it was first and foremost in the affidavit that Jeff Hooper, the executive director, signed in support of the underlying summary judgment motion. So we have, at a trial court proceeding, a summary judgment submitted with an affidavit from Jeff Hooper that says, we complied with rules 37 and 38. And therefore, you cannot interfere. And we argued that there was what I called at that time a so long as exception, that the case authority is fairly consistent in finding that you cannot interfere so long as the private association conducts its affairs in a manner consistent with notions of fairness and equity and fundamental due process. That was not done here.
How do you address the argument that the settlement, compromise and settlement agreement basically cuts off all claims for failure to follow the rules prior to entry into that agreement?
A couple of ways, Justice Walker. First of all, they didn't comply with the settlement agreement. And the judge's grant of summary judgment with respect to their motion on the settlement agreement is something that we're also seeking to overturn. There is a very clear dispute, a swearing match, if you will, between Clark Brewster, counsel for Laney Whitmire on the one hand, and Eldridge Goins, as counsel for the NCHA on the other hand, as to what that agreement even was. And we even have further evidence that reflect contemporaneous renditions of Mr. Brewster's version of affairs and his version of the facts at that time that we believe made clear that Mr. Brewster received the January 19th letter. Well, of course, we point out in our briefing here that there's no signature on that letter. There's no evidence of our assent to the terms of that agreement. In fact, we also point out that the letter from Mr. Goins didn't even have a signature line for Mr. Brewster and Ms. Whitmire to sign signifying their assent. And therefore, that's not an agreement. In fact, the letter goes on to state that if there's any problem with this, please contact me. Mr. Brewster testified that he did contact Mr. Goins. He said, basically, what's the deal with your letter? It's not what we agreed to. And Mr. Brewster testified that he received assurances from Mr. Goins, basically to the effect of, don't worry about the letter. It's posturing for the benefit of some particular constituency in the association. We have a deal. And Clark confirmed, our deal is as we discussed, and he said yes. Now, Ms. Whitmire testifies, she calls Mr. Brewster. What's the deal with the letter? This isn't what we agreed. Don't worry about it, Laney. This is the way it works. I have assurances from Mr. Goins, who at all times relevant to their negotiations and interactions together, was acting as counsel for the NCHA. I have assurances from Eldridge Goins that our agreement is intact. He's a senior lawyer, and I'm a senior lawyer, and our word is our bond. Ms. Whitmire testifies, as does Susan Marvin, that contemporaneous with those transactions, Ms. Whitmire calls Susan Marvin, expresses her concerns. I don't think we should trust Eldridge. I'm concerned. Our agreement that Clark's telling me is in place is not what's in the letter. Susan says that that conversation did take place, and she said, well, Clark's the pro. He's the expert. He's the lawyer. I think we got to go with what he's saying. So we have all sorts of controverting evidence that support Clark Brewster's version of events with respect to that contract. And then we have the fact that that was also an agreement or a letter that they sent to us on January 19th, 2005, which was in response to a history that started first with the grievance committee revoking her amateur card, but then requesting further findings in connection with her non-pro status. There was a hearing set in January for that purpose. The hearing was moved to January 19th. Mr. Brewster, as the record clearly indicates, wrote Mr. Goins saying, we are prepared to present unqualified sworn testimony that she never at any time trained horses astride for remuneration. And we're willing to sit for yet again a second lie detector exam. She passed the first one. And we're agreeing to sit for a second lie detector exam by an examiner of the NCHA's own choosing. It was in response to that letter from Mr. Brewster that the testimony reflected that the negotiations ensued and a compromise settlement was reached. Now they fault Laney Whitmire for the fact that, well, she didn't appeal anything from that particular grievance committee's findings. Well, yeah, because she thought she had a settlement agreement, because they'd reached a settlement. They'd compromised. And so it was a done issue. And she waited for the requisite period, and she reapplied for membership. I mean, if you look at Mr. Goins' letter, he was meeting out additional discipline well beyond anything that the grievance committee had recommended.
Now, why didn't the appellant appeal the other rulings that came subsequent to that?
There was an appeal taken of the finding that she had trained horses astride for remuneration. That appeal was denied, and that is the subject of our case. Now, concurrently with that appellate hearing, there was also a hearing that because when she reapplied, she persisted in taking the position that she was not a professional trainer, they said, well, now you're making a false declaration because we've already found that you are a professional trainer. And so we went forward on that hearing, and they were conducted concurrently. And so once they ruled on the appeal that she was a professional trainer and they revoked her membership for making a false declaration, then there was, with respect to the gravamen of the complaint, whether or not she'd ever trained horses astride for compensation of some form, that had been appealed and finally denied and resolved. That's what we filed a lawsuit on. We haven't appealed or filed a lawsuit in connection with, you know, their ruling on the false declaration.
But aren't those issues or the claims involved in those issues, aren't they all interrelated?
Well, they are to the extent, Your Honor, that there was a final determination that the NCHA had concluded she was a trainer for compensation. And that's what our lawsuit is complaining about. Now, as to whether or not she makes a false declaration, it would be our intention that when we establish in court that she's never been a trainer for remuneration, that's never been the case, then we would go back to the NCHA and ask that they reconsider their prior indication that she made a false statement for asserting that she's not a professional trainer. But once they decided on the final appeal that she had trained horses professionally for remuneration, trained horses astride, and she'd violated that rule, then that was the essence of the issue. That is what's before you, and that's what we're appealing. And so the membership revocation, everything that's transpired from that relates to their initial investigation and insistence that she'd trained horses for remuneration. And you can look back at the history of this dispute and see that it started on November 1, 2004, with a letter from the executive director saying, we have received a complaint. And that complaint, the synopsis of that complaint is that you've trained horses astride for remuneration. That was what the hearing was about that Mr. Brewster attended as counsel for Laney Whitmire. Now, throughout the course of that, it was interesting, as we pointed out, that they went forward and Mr. Brewster was asking Laney about, well, have you ever seen the written complaint? And Mr. Goins howls him down and says, stop wasting our time. There's no 37 complaint here. What's difficult for us to understand is how, when the general counsel of the NCHA, Mr. Goins, takes that position at that hearing, despite what the letter said, that initiated the investigation by the grievance committee that was seeking to impose discipline for a rule violation, which would be consistent with the dictates of Rule 37. Why he would then file a pleading in the same trial court, in this trial court, the underlying court of this case, where they would submit an affidavit to Jeff Hooper, the executive director, to sign under oath saying that he complied with Rules 37 and 38, that in fact he received a written complaint that initiated that investigation. But then Mr. Hooper, just 19 days later, as I recall, I think it was just 19 days later, after signing the affidavit, testifies in a deposition, well, no, I'm not aware of any written complaint. And yet, despite the fact that even on that one issue, the genesis of the entire dispute, that what precipitated and initiated the investigation that led to the discipline meted out to Laney Whitmire on the issue of whether or not she was a professional trainer, they contradicted their own testimony. I mean, Mr. Hooper actually signs an affidavit in support of the motion before you that says there was a written complaint and we were following Rule 37 and we followed Rule 38 and because we complied with our rules, you cannot interfere. And yet Mr. Hooper testifies in the deposition that he's not aware of a written complaint. Gail Karangis, who was a member of the committee, and Bucky James, who was the chair of the committee, both said they'd never seen a written complaint. And so, you know, while it's, I think, presumed in many, many appeals that there's two sides to every story, the problem that we have here, and one reason that we believe that our appeal should be granted and the underlying summary judgment should be reversed, is because there's two sides to the NCHA story. And that's a real problem in our view, because, and we would urge the court to look very carefully at the summary judgment motion they filed before Judge Lowe that was actually granted, that you look very carefully at the evidence they submitted in the form of Jeff Hooper's affidavit that was supporting that motion that was actually granted based upon that affidavit, and look at what they're saying here today. Now they're contending, really, they ignore Rule 37 altogether. On the point of the Rule 38 couldn't be more clear that in connection with any rule violation, that the burden of proof is on the NCHA to establish the violation of that rule. And yet all the witnesses, Karangis, James, Hooper, they all admit that, well, no, the burden of proof was imposed on Laney. She was supposed to prove that she wasn't a professional trainer. Well, how does one go about proving a negative? I mean, Rule 38 makes sense if it's actually applied. I mean, the NCHA, if it's initiating and investigating a rule violation, should have the burden of proof of establishing that rule violation as Rule 38 prescribes, no question. And yet, in this case, they all admit that, well, the burden of proof was placed on Laney. Now, he doesn't say anything about, you know, the extent to which, you know, Rule 8 and Rule 9, that they're eligibility rules. They fault the fact that Clark Brewster submitted a white paper on that. Well, of course, those are the substantive rules that were at issue that they said she had violated. But the procedural rules governing the administration of this process and the administration of the hearing and the presentation of evidence and the refutation of evidence that was supposed to take place and be allowed were being conducted and followed under Rule 37 and 38. That's what their summary judgment says, and that's what they failed to establish. They have not established as a matter of law that they complied with their own rules, and because of that central failure, the summary judgments must be overturned. And as we've briefed on the standard of review, because they should be overturned, it's incumbent then upon a fact finder to determine simply, did the NCHA comply with their own rules? Because they did not meet their burden of establishing that there was no genuine issue of material fact that would support the underlying summary judgment that we now appeal.
Now, counsel, did yes, the sir. Court dismiss any part of the suit for on jurisdictional grounds, or, you know, because there was no exhaustion of administrative remedies. Was that an issue?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, it was simply a jurisdictional motion and finding on the doctrine of judicial noninterference. Mm-hmm. And so based upon what the court found was their motion, I mean, that they complied with their rules, then
well,
he
no,
granted
I'm,
their
I'm just asking
motion.
If I don't have the judgment. I don't believe that the judgment's attached as an appendix to any of the briefs, and I'm just wondering if the court dismissed a portion of this. I understand the court did sever
yes, sir.
To the claims.
He did retain a couple of claims, yes, sir.
Okay.
And I don't believe that he did beyond simply granting the summary judgment. Very quickly, I'm out of time. I believe that our brief on the other two points certainly addresses those issues. If there are any questions, I'll be glad to address them during my rebuttal.
I have a question quickly.
Yes, Justice Walker.
It seems like you're saying that the judicial non-intervention doctrine should not apply if there's any violation of any private association's rules. And it seems to me that the law is more that the doctrine will not apply if there's a deprivation of due process or some kind of fundamental right. And it seems to me like in this case, even though according to your allegations, the summary judgment evidence establishes that every I wasn't dotted and every T wasn't crossed in the following of the procedural rules, that Laney was given notice of all the hearings and had the opportunity to appear at all the hearings and was represented by counsel. And so is there case law out there that says that that makes that distinction or that says that every violation nonetheless, every violation of an association's rules, the judicial non-intervention doctrine is blocked or will not apply?
Well,
how do we address that?
Yes, that's a fine question. I'll try to address it as summarily as possible. I don't believe that it's our position that any violation of the rules rises to the level of what I've called the so long as exception, that so long as they don't offend notions of fairness or equity or justice, or so long as they don't violate the law, so long as they don't offend due process. But they've teed up the motion in a way that we think is a fair statement of law. That is, you cannot interfere because we complied with our rules. The problem is that in attempting to establish that compliance, they failed altogether. They're contradicting, Mr. Hooper, for example, is contradicting his own affidavit testimony in his deposition. And so there can be, we think, no proper finding that as a matter of law that summary judgment is appropriate on the face of the summary judgment record before you in response and in light of the actual motion that was briefed and the position taken.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. Mr. Morris.
Good morning, panel. Justice Casey, may I turn this?
Sure.
May it please the court. I put this exhibit up here, which is also contained in our appellate brief. It's a chronology of the case. I realize it might be a little hard to see, but I thought it was important for this reason. And after listening to counsel's argument, I think it's even more important. We've had many hearings on this case at the trial court level, and one of the problems is we keep getting way away from the summary judgment record and what the law is. And what's presented on this case, on this chronology, is what is in the record. And I would like to start my presentation by just going over the law real quick, because I think Justice Walker raised some questions about that. And the judicial non-intervention doctrine, which governs almost all of the claims made by plaintiff in this case, is a very strong doctrine and perhaps best stated by this court in the Hardin versus Colonial Country Club, where Justice Jordan says, courts are not disposed to interfere with the internal management of a voluntary association. The right of such an organization to interpret its own agreements, laws, and regulations after they made and are adopted is not inferior to its right to make and adopt them. As a member, by becoming such, each one subjects himself within the legal limits to the organization's power to administer as well as to make its rules. And we submit to the court that that is exactly, in a lot of different guises, what they are asking this court to do. They are asking this court to step behind not only one, but three different procedures in which notice, hearing, right to present evidence, and right to cross-examine witnesses were all afforded to appellant. They want the court to step behind a settlement agreement which was reached between the parties and which was acted in accordance with by both parties, and I'll get to that in a minute. But with regard to this judicial non-intervention doctrine, in light of that, and in answer to Justice Walker's question, there's basically two things that you get: notice and opportunity to be heard. And those are the two things you get under Texas law, and those are the exceptions. If you do not get notice and you do not get opportunity to be heard, then perhaps the judicial non-intervention doctrine would not apply and you would step behind and see what happened. As a matter of fact, and these cases are all in the brief, but if the court looks at the legion of cases that are out there, beginning with Hardin versus Colonial Country Club, they are all cases decided as a matter of law under the judicial non-intervention doctrine. Hardin versus Colonial was a summary judgment case on the very same type of thing, issue of whether or not membership was properly removed. Judicial non-intervention doctrine, summary judgment granted. Burge versus AQHA, which is out of Amarillo in 1990, summary judgment in favor of the association on issues regarding horse registration. Again, as a matter of law, non-intervention doctrine. Campbell versus American Psychologist Association, Western District of Texas, 1999, matter of law, summary judgment on claims challenging membership suspension, similar to claims made here. One of the questions raised by Justice Casey was, did the court rule on this failure to exhaust administrative remedies doctrine? That was squarely within our summary judgment motion. The court did not specifically rule individually on each one, but we asserted with regard to the membership issues that failure to appeal those decisions was barred by the failure to exhaust administrative remedies doctrine. That's the Juarez case, and we believe that courts granted us judgment on those grounds as well with regard to the membership issues. Lawrence versus Ridgeview Country Club, summary judgment on claims challenging membership suspension based on Texas non-intervention doctrine. Again, claims similar to what appellant makes here.
So you would contend that we should dismiss as all of the membership claim issues because we lack jurisdiction for failure to exhaust administrative remedies?
I think those would apply to all issues with regard to membership. Yes, Your Honor, I do. I believe that is true. Each and every one of the cases cited in the briefs decides as a matter of law on claims similar to what's been raised here by the appellant that the judicial non-intervention doctrine blocks such claims. There is one case that they cite that holds to the contrary. That case is the Hatley versus AQHA case. It's out of the Fifth Circuit. It decides against the association on the ground that no hearing was afforded to the member. Those are the grounds for that decision. It does not second guess what they did. It just says, under Texas law, you get two things, notice and hearing. Well, you told them you were going to remove this registration certificate for a horse, but you didn't give them a chance to be heard, and you can't do that. Only case. This case is nothing like Hatley and is exactly like the other cases that we've cited to the court, and that's why I've put this chronology up here, to illustrate how many places in the record and what kind of process appellant has been given, because the NCHA asserts that not only has the process afforded by law been given, but we have gone above and beyond what is required by law. If law requires notice of specific charges relating to horse training activities, that was done both on August 23rd and November 1st. Specific letters in the record giving appellant notice of what the complaints were. If the law requires opportunity to be heard, we have exhausted that in spades. She got hearings on the 15th of November, the 21st of, that was 2004, another hearing on August 21st of 2006, which is demonstrated here, and another hearing was afforded on November the 19th of 2007. Each one of those hearings, notice was provided, the charges were made known to her. Those are all different panels of people. This is not the same one or two people deciding.
Excuse me, I'm a little bit confused about these facts. Maybe you can help me out. There was one complaint, right?
Yes.
And there was a settlement agreement in 2005.
Correct.
And there was an agreed 6-month membership suspension.
Correct.
But then in 2006, there's a 1-year suspension. And then there's a question of automatic reinstatement. If there's a 6-month membership suspension, why doesn't that then include an automatic reinstatement? And where does the 1-year suspension come from? I'm just confused.
Let me explain that, Your Honor. This is extremely abbreviated for purposes of space. The settlement agreement, let's start there. That provided for two things: a 6-month membership suspension, that's number one, and an indefinite revocation of amateur and non-professional status within the organization. The NCHA has all these different classes of people that can compete: amateurs, non-professionals, so on and so forth. And so what part of the settlement that's in the record, and it specifically states, as a member, you will be suspended for 6 months. After 6 months, you will come back in, but your amateur and non-professional designations are revoked, and they are forfeited because you've trained horses as a profession. Now, the second proceeding in August of 2006 resulted at appellant's request, because after the 6-month membership suspension was up, she came back within the association and competed in the open class, which allows anyone of any designation to compete. She made repeated applications to become a non-pro again, claiming that the rule had changed and that she qualified. Her attorney, Mr. Walker, in the spring of 2006, here at appellant's request, asked the NCHA to go ahead and reconsider her application for non-pro status. The entire committee, which is not even provided for by the rules. That's a decision that's normally made by staff, but we gave the entire non-professional committee, reviewed it, decided that, number one, she wasn't qualified for a non-professional status, and number two, she had made false statements, which would, in their opinion, justify an additional 1-year membership suspension.
Yeah, I'm curious about that. There was a polygraph in there at some point?
The polygraph examinations were before the settlement agreement. And they were never, the NCHA initially suggested it might want a polygraph and then said no.
So anytime y'all rule against somebody, then they've automatically made false statements?
No, Your Honor, that's not at all. I mean, it happens all the time that we rule against people and that false statements are not made. What happened here is that there was evidence before the committee, and the evidence is in the record in terms of those hearing transcripts, training horses, tax returns, other things where she had made statement where it was clear that she had become a professional horse trainer. So, no, it doesn't happen in every circumstance, no.
Okay. And so then it was suspended for another year.
Right.
So the agreement was reached, complied with, and over. And then the suspension had nothing to do, the 1-year suspension had nothing to do with the agreement, so there'd be no point in appealing that agreement, I assume, since everybody complied with it.
Well, and I'd like to address that point on the compliance with the agreement, because there seems to be some question about that. Mr. Walker suggests that the agreement was not complied with, but the record is just pretty clear, again, as we go back to it otherwise. The agreement was reached, suspension for 6 months. The NCHA complied with that. Appellant complied with that. She did not compete for 6 months. The agreement also says, in the event the rules change sometime in the future, you will not be prejudiced from reapplying. That's where all this came into play. Mm-hmm. Under the changed rules, she felt like she could qualify, and she did not under the NCHA's determination. So 6-month suspension, honored by both sides. Revocation of amateur and professional status, honored by both sides. Ms. Whitmire came back. She competed in the open class. She makes repeated applications for non-professional status, which are denied. This whole idea that there was some side agreement for automatic reinstatement in 6 months is belied by the entire record. She came back in. She never mentioned that ever to the NCHA, and the record's clear, and her actions are clear. She came back and competed as in the open division. She made repeated requests to try and requalify under the new rule. In this hearing, on August 21, requested by Mr. Walker, the transcript of which is in the record, there is not one mention anywhere in that transcript, which I think is 30 or 40 pages long, of any agreement for automatic reinstatement. The very issue that he is asking for a hearing on, granting of non-professional status, which they now allege, and again, not until an amended petition in this case, not even in the original petition is this agreement mentioned. Not until an amended petition in this case is filed is that agreement mentioned. In this August 21st hearing, Mr. Walker appears, presents evidence, says nothing about any oral agreement for automatic reinstatement. But maybe the best evidence of what the agreement was comes as a result of Ms. Whitmire's own testimony, where she said in her deposition, I asked her, letters that were sent in connection with your reapplication. She said, yes, there was a rule change, so I reapplied. All right, a rule change to what? Answer, the non-pro rule. Okay, and why was it important to you that there was a rule change? Answer, I just thought it might open the door and let me reapply. That's what Ms. Whitmire testified to. There is no question that the parties agreed to, honored, and abided by the settlement agreement, that they acted in accordance with it, and that is the only agreement that was authorized. The court never even gets to this oral agreement because, as stated in the brief, it was the burden of appellant to say that Mr. Goins was authorized to make such an agreement and or the NCHA ratified it. They neither pled that nor presented any proof whatsoever on that issue. The final issue that's raised, and they didn't really get to this, but they make a claim that their claims for fraud and negligent misrepresentation were not within our summary judgment motion. They were. We cite that to the court in the brief. It's not only in the general request for relief, but we specifically reference the paragraphs in which they made those claims and asked for relief and received those from the court. And so there are three points. Number one, they want you to go behind the judicial non-intervention doctrine no matter what they say, and that's not allowed by this court's opinion or any court's opinion. Number two, the settlement agreement was clearly agreed to and operated under by the parties, and any alleged oral side agreement doesn't get to there because they have not pled or presented any proof, and we filed a no-evidence motion for summary judgment on that point as well. No evidence in the record showing authority of Goins and or ratification by the NCHA. And finally, all of the claims on which the court granted summary judgment were encompassed within our pleadings. And so we believe that the court should affirm the trial court in all respects, and to do otherwise, we believe, would put the court in violation of the judicial non-intervention rule. And I'll go back one last time to the Colonial Country Club case, because I think Justice Jordan sums it up best when he says, if courts were to interfere every time some member, group of members, had a grievance, real or imagined, the nonprofit organization would be fraught with frustration at every turn and would founder in the water of impotence and debility. If you accept the arguments made by the plaintiff on the record presented in this case, that's exactly where you're going to put the NCHA. And we believe this court has already ruled on that issue and ought to stay with its ruling in Colonial Country Club and affirm the trial court here on the summary judgments. I see I'm out of time unless there's any questions.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
As to the oral representations, why is that not governed by just general contract rules? I mean, I'm not understanding why the judicial non-intervention doctrine would apply to that type of a claim.
I don't think we've asserted that, and if I've said that, I've misspoken. On the oral representations, this supposed oral agreement, they've pled it as an oral contract. And under the law, as cited in our briefing, they are required to plead that the contract was made, that somebody with authority made it, and or it was ratified by the corporation. They neither pled nor presented any evidence of somebody of that authority was given to Mr. Goins to make such an agreement or that the NCHA ratified such an agreement. In fact, the only evidence in the record is the evidence of the then-time president, Mr. Bussey, who testified that the only agreement that was ever agreed to or ratified by the NCHA was what was contained in the January 19th letter.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morris.
Thank you.
Mr. Walker.
I'd like to address a few distinct issues that have been raised, and I'm hopeful that I can answer any questions you might have about them. First of all, this is not a Campbell case. It's not a Colonial case. Colonial was a situation where the member acknowledged that the bylaws provided certain procedures for the payment of the transfer fee and the transfer of the membership. He just didn't like the rules. In Campbell, the psychiatrist admitted that she had failed to disclose the dual representation, and the fact that she, within the context of the dual representation, that she'd failed to disclose she'd had a prior sexual relationship with the husband of the couple that she was counseling. She violated the APA's ethics rule. She acknowledged that. She just didn't think it was a good rule or it should be applied under the light, in light of those circumstances. This is not a situation where Lainey Whitmire has ever admitted that she professionally trained horses for remuneration at any time. And this is not a situation where we believe that she's been afforded due process. Their motion in the trial court that was granted that we're appealing simply said, you cannot interfere because we complied with our rules. And all the cases he cited to, they do have statements saying, well, you know, as long as the association, comports themselves with their rules, and so long as they don't violate, you know, any notions of due process or fairness or anything like that, and as long as they're within the bounds of the law, you know, we're not going to interfere. But here in this case, there was no admission that she violated the rules. And here in this case, we've established on the face of the record that they failed to comply with their rules. And that was their motion for summary judgment that the trial court granted. And so when they come in now and they try to recharacterize their argument, and there's some rules that they mention on their appellate brief that they didn't mention in the underlying brief, and there's a completely different cast taken to things, it's because we believe they recognize that when you submit a single affidavit from Jeff Hooper supporting your summary judgment saying, we complied with our rules, Rule 37 and 38, we received a written complaint, we initiated the investigation, we convened the grievance committee, we meted out the discipline. Yeah, there was a hearing. But the problem was that at that very same hearing, the same lawyer whose law firm gave Mr. Hooper the affidavit and filed the motion for summary judgment in the trial court arguing they complied with the rules was the very same gentleman who said that it was not a Rule 37 proceeding. I mean, the most ironclad renunciation of the affidavit proof submitted in support of their motion was Mr. Goins' own statement. And it contradicts the very pleading that his own law firm filed in this case.
Isn't the key, though, whether there was notice and opportunity to be heard, not whether they properly applied their own rules and so forth?
Actually, no, Your Honor. I believe that it's important for them to comport themselves with procedural due process and with their procedural rules, 37 and 38. Their summary judgment motion was teed up on that issue.
Was there not notice given?
There was notice of the November 15 hearing. You're correct.
There were opportunities to be heard, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, there was, Your Honor.
So
but the problem,
where is the procedural due process problem?
Well, because she was advised that there was a complaint and that complaint had been received, and they provided her a synopsis describing the complaint. And then they file a summary judgment motion saying that in connection with our compliance with Rule 37, we received a complaint, we had a hearing to investigate that complaint, and we meted out discipline in connection with that investigation. The problem is that after they file their summary judgment motion, they admit under oath in their deposition, well, actually, we didn't get a complaint. So the entirety of the proceeding that was initiated on November 1, conducted on November 15, and ruled upon by the Grievance Committee on November 16 was predicated on a lie. There was no complaint. No one came to the NCHA and said, I want to complain about this woman's misconduct at a show. No one filed the $50 complaint fee.
Actually, it creates an issue of fact, doesn't it, that would preclude summary judgment?
That's precisely what we're saying, and all we're asking, Justice Dauphin knows, that we get to go back and submit this. And we believe in application of the proper standard of review that this court cannot rule as a matter of law that the summary judgment was appropriate under these circumstances, that there is a question of fact with respect to whether or not they complied with their rules. That was the motion teed up, and they can point to all the hearings in the world. But it's a qualitative thing, and what we're looking at is the quantitative, I mean, the qualitative issue, not some quantitative analysis. We had 50 hearings. I mean, most of the hearings that they're looking at, we're not even complaining about. And so what we're complaining about is the first hearing, the hearing on November 15, and then the appeal of that hearing, which we did exhaust our administrative remedies. And Chief Justice Casey, in response to your question, there was no dismissal by the trial court on those grounds. And the other thing that bothers me is that this argument that presumes a binding settlement agreement. Where is the binding settlement agreement in the January 19, 2005 letter? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. There's no signature of our assent on the agreement. We have all sorts of testimony from Clark Brewster, Susan Marvin, and Lainey Whitmire that contradict Mr. Goins' testimony in that respect. They have absolutely no binding agreement at all. And so the one thing they do have is they have our conduct that's consistent with the agreement that Ms. Whitmire thought that we had cut. and that is that she came back and reapplied as a non-professional after the six-month suspension period of her membership had expired, because she believed that was the deal. And it was only upon finding that it was not the deal that we filed our lawsuit. And I apologize for running out of time, but I very much appreciate your attention and courtesy.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. Mr. Morris, co-counsel, the court appreciates your arguments this morning. I'm still not sure I understand what trained horses astride means, but I'm sure we can decide this case.
It means you ride them when you train them rather than sitting behind
okay.
them.
The case is submitted, and we have no further arguments here this morning, so we'll ask clerk to adjourn us. Thank you.